All right, everyone, welcome to the show. This is Pseudo Intellectual Live. As always, I appreciate you tuning in today. We have a very special guest. She is the executive director of Rebellion Pack, a former congressional candidate and a software engineer. Please welcome to the show, Brianna Wu. Brianna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Lauren. You know, I was really looking forward to this. I do a lot of media, but everyone says you're one of the very nicest people in all of media. You know, Lauren, my friend Lauren Southern, she says great things about you. Sean over at the Actual Justice Warrior, he says great things
my
about
people.
You. So really looking forward to this today.
Thanks. And, you know, speaking of, you know, being nice, I want to apologize to everybody. And thank you, Brianna, for the schedule change. We usually try to go live every Wednesday. Was traveling for some family health stuff. So I appreciate everyone's flexibility. It really means a lot. But we have so much to talk about. And so, I mean, it's kind of hard deciding where to jump to things. But as a starting off point, why don't we kind of go over where you see yourself politically? You know, Rebellion Pack, I was looking at their page a little bit. They describe themselves, or the organization describes itself, as kind of like progressive. Is that a fair label? And obviously we can have a discussion as to what exactly that means, but by and large, would you call yourself a progressive?
I definitely would, which is why, you know, kind of the current progressive politics, I feel so betrayed by kind of the way it's gone, particularly in the last few years. You may not know this about me, but yeah, I grew up in Mississippi, which is one of the poorest states in the country. I saw how, you know, the poorest people in Mississippi were sent to fight wars. I saw how we did not have the same investment in, Mississippi that we needed to get ahead and have an equal shot. And, you know, that is very much at odds with what I see the progressive movement turning into, which is increasingly kind of witch test, like witch burning online, and just really moving away from the bread and butter economics that I increasingly feel more in common with the right on. So it's very frustrating. Do you see that tension at all from kind of where you sit?
Absolutely. And I feel like there's a big difference between general movements and the people who I think are representing those movements is what I would say. Yeah. So labels, but I identify as like right-wing conservative. And I look at people who are currently representing the movement, people like Mike Johnson, someone even like Nikki Haley. And I can't help but think, okay, but not like that. Those aren't my politics. Right. And I feel like there is a big difference, especially when we're looking at, establishment versus populace of either side. One of the shows that I watch quite a lot just to get kind of a little bit of a understanding of the other side is the Young Turks. And I do find it interesting that they almost spend as much time complaining about the Democrats as the Republicans because they feel like there's no representation there. And it's interesting, especially, I mean, not so much the case with maybe you, and we can go into foreign policy, but even looking at, stuff that's happening right now in the Middle East, I find it interesting that there's almost, it's not really a left-right divide so much as it is, I don't even think it's fair to say establishment populist in that regard, but I just feel like the old assumption where it's either left or right and that kind of signifies where you're at, it doesn't paint the full picture anymore.
No, I definitely agree with that. You know, and one of the people that started Rebellion Pack with me is Cenk Uygur, who is, you know, obviously launched the Young Turks. I have differences with him right now, obviously, over Israel Hamas. I have a different assessment of what the United States' role should be as far as, you know, what some are calling the new axis for in the new allies as we're looking at what the trade and organizing principle of the United States economy is going to look like. But I think more than that, and forgive me if this is oversimplifying, I hope this doesn't come across as attacking you, but I really feel like the Democratic Party is becoming the same as MAGA, just like shifted 10 years, right? And to be clear, I think there are reasonable people that support Donald Trump and had a lot of good reasons to be on that train. Right. Many of my friends I grew up with in Mississippi are some of them. But I think somewhere at the core of it, there was a sense that the elites had failed the average Americans. And the response to that was kind of a desire to burn everything down. And I remember all through 2016 looking at, mobs of people like getting into fights at Donald Trump rallies. And it's a little less funny today when I see, you know, my friends in the progressive movement, you know, shutting off access to the Holocaust Museum, crying free Yemen, and supporting, you know, who I view in the United States officially views as a terrorist group. So I think increasingly what I'm looking for, and I can say Cenk is looking for as well, is kind of sidestepping more of these culture wars, which, to be fair, this is where I became a national figure, fighting those culture wars, which is why I feel really qualified to say they're not getting us better policy. So I think we would be far better served to take a step back, to really think hard, like, what are the policy positions we have that we share with the right? What are the things we can get done that will make the country better for average Americans, and focus on that? That's kind of the only way forward I can figure for the country.
Right. Now, I agree that the culture war, you know, it's not necessarily, and I mean, it's hard because I think a lot of people on the right specifically feel like, yes, it almost is a waste of time talking about, you know, trans issues in school. Like, this isn't actually going to help you get a job or anything like that. It's not going to improve the economy. But I think when it comes to the culture war, a lot of people just feel like we've been on the defensive a long time, if you're more conservative or right leaning. So, you know, to say, like, is this really something we should be focusing on? Well, it's easy to say that if you're in a winning position, I think is how the sentiment is going. But, you know, kind of speaking of culture war stuff, let's talk about Hollywood feminism, because this is something you brought up specifically, and it's something you've kind of spoken a little bit about. What do you think of Hollywood feminists? Because I have a media channel, Mediaholic, and basically it's just pop culture stuff. And it's funny that Hollywood feminism, well, we all know what that means. Like, before we even go into the topic, we all know what Hollywood feminism is, because even though it's supposed to be entertainment, essentially it's this brand of feminism that's, it's very affluent, it's very surface level. What are your thoughts there? And do you think that it's kind of subverting a more important message that we should be focusing on?
Well, I think one of my very first forays into kind of getting a sense of this was working with various people in Hollywood to turn Gamergate into a television show, right? And the original impetus for doing this, or the original vision for it, was more of a kind of feminist horror movie, right? The alt-right is hunting Brianna Wu and Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkeesian. And I was just like, yeah, I'm just not interested in this. It's cheesy. It's not really worthwhile. And, you know, something really struck me through the many attempts to kind of turn this into a television show is how few women there were in the loop, and just how superficial all of the conversations about it were. The Gamergate pilot I really wanted to tell, and I'm going to break some news today, was to really focus on, to tell kind of a story of a lost generation of young men. I'm sure, do you have boys or do you have girls? I forgive
Girl.
Me for not knowing. Girls.
Yeah.
But I imagine if you did have a boy, you would be really worried about what it was like for him growing up today, right? Like, in an increasingly online space. Why are so many young men kind of losing their way and failing to launch and failing to connect with other people? I wanted to really tell an unflinching story of what that was going to look like, and it was really hard getting buy-in. So I don't know. I think that increasingly diversity in Hollywood, it just feels more like checklists and very pandering, rather than, you know, doing what I care about, which is just seeing women being, you know, having agency and being interesting people, if that makes sense.
No, for sure. So, but okay, let's backtrack a little bit. So
please,
yeah. Hollywood, they wanted to adapt Gamergate into a series.
Yes.
And basically, it was like, what, like horror of women being hunted down by these alt-right trolls online?
Pretty much, yeah. Very similar to the Gamergate Law & Order episode, which is just, you know, it's not good. I don't know if you've seen it.
So, no.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. I don't recommend it.
That's interesting. So what, you know, if you're of the belief that, okay, that's not maybe an accurate or fair representation of what happened, how would you kind of, and, you know, I see people talking about it in the chat, and at the same time, like, let's mention it, but also with the understanding that this is something that happened, what, 10 years ago
at this point? Oh, I'm not interested in relitigating it. It is my jumping off part to understanding Hollywood, if that makes sense.
Right. I guess, like, what would you have felt would be a more fair way to portray it than what you were offered, if that makes sense?
I wanted to tell it as a, or rather the story I'm interested in telling, or what I'm more interested in, is kind of seeing the humanity in each other. And I'm more interested in, like, what's going on here? Because the truth of the video game industry is you have a lot of, frankly, leftist men that work there in one of the most sexist industries in the entire world that just historically has been extremely unfair in how it treats women. Can't blame that on, you know, Glenn Beck. Like, it's mostly Democrats that work in the video game industry. So kind of what's going on there? What's kind of happening with, you know, the culture of feminism, which I feel in that era really got focused on the superficial rather than focusing on policies that would really, really make women's lives better. I think it's so telling that so much of the conversation was about, you know, online harassment, which is bad, but so little of it was about, like, what happens to women in the game industry after they have kids. So I feel like it really got turned into this war that was impossible to win. And that was kind of what I wanted to focus on.
Okay. And so I feel like when it comes to Hollywood feminism, and I'm not familiar with the insides of the gaming industry, never worked in gaming before, but I feel like there's almost a desire for some people to turn the issue into, let's focus on the other rather than examining how we're contributing to problems. And I think, right, like, a perfect example of Hollywood that we all know is the whole Weinstein issue, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this, even though we can all say, oh yeah, he was a bad guy, let's blacklist him now. Truth is, he was operating for decades in Hollywood, being very, very predatory toward women. We even have men like Terry Crews and, I believe, Brendan Fraser, who have kind of been subjected similarly to very, very predatory behavior. No one was really talking about that before it became an issue. There are still, I'm sure, many executives, many people in the industry who are operating with that, you know, same MO, basically pay to play, sexual favors, let's exploit women who are looking for an in. But at the same time, we see the most virtue signaling we've ever seen in entertainment. Every movie, it seems like, has this message. But I mean, is that the people who are doing this, do you think there's, like, a genuine desire for feminism and to empower women? Or is this almost just like a way to say, hey, don't look at me over here, let's focus on these guys? Like, do they know that they're kind of being hypocrites, or is this just, I guess, being naive?
I think what I've seen of Hollywood is a tremendous amount of insecurity and narcissism and just frankly, very, very few women. As I was kind of working to, you know, try to get Gamergate to be a good project, I was consistently shocked by how few women were in any meeting I took ever. So I think, unfortunately, rather than viewing it through the correct lens, which is, you know, hey, you know, women watch a lot of media. You know, how can we kind of make sure that we have a safe workplace that I think all of us would agree with? I think it very quickly turns into, you know, what some people call virtue signaling, right? The appearance of X, Y, and Z. And it's two very, very different things. I think a really good example of this is, you know, the Marvels, which just came out. You know, Captain Marvel 1, it wasn't a terrible film, but it wasn't a good film either, right? And what they needed to do for that was to really, you know, double down on Brie Larson's story, her character, really give her some more emotional depth, you know, really explore that character. Instead, what we got was just it was a pandering list of what I think women are supposed to like in movies, and, you know, shoehorning a bunch of different protagonists in to, like, you know, in a way that felt very artificial. They should have been focused on telling a better story, and I think it suffered because of that.
Okay, so that's you kind of touched on something that I think is really interesting there, and that's mm-hmm. the fact, and it is a fact that there's not a lot of women in the gaming industry. I think now it's changed, but I think, you know, historically, fair to say, not a very female dominated industry. When you say sexism in the video game industry, because again, I haven't worked in there, are you referring simply to disproportionate male influence, or are there like actual, because I see those things as different, right? Because in conservative media as well, it's no secret that obviously very male dominated. I think media tends to be more male dominated, and obviously conservatives more male. So especially in conservative media, you're definitely looking at, you know, fewer women. But I think the way I've been treated by conservative media, the actual, you know, industry insiders, has been pretty fair. So here we have disproportionate male representation, but that's not necessarily reflected in open sexism. When you say sexism in the video game industry, are you merely talking about the fact that there's more men, or are you saying like actually, you know, there's, let's say, like, I think something like sexual harassment would be considered sexist, assuming women aren't as competent. Like, basically, like, can we get a little bit more detail about what you think of is at play there?
Sure. So, you know, fair point. I've not worked in the video game industry for quite a few years now, as my job has shifted over to politics. But this is what I saw while I was working there. It was very, very common for young women just coming out of school to be treated as, you know, basically people to date rather than professionals looking to get their start in the gaming industry. I'm not going to tell you which AAA studio, but I pulled some strings in back channel to get a just really, really bright young woman that I met on one of my college speaking tours, a job at a AAA studio. And I got a call at 3 a.m. one night. And she had been out drinking with, you know, her team in California, and her boss had, you know, basically put himself on her in front of all of her teammates. She was really embarrassed. She felt devalued. She didn't feel like anyone there really valued her for what she could bring to the industry. And she ended up quitting when HR didn't do anything about it because it was outside of work. So there's that aspect of it. Something I think is more telling is I really urge you to go look for any game dev team. Look at who makes it into middle and senior management. Look at who gets to be a creative lead, a writing lead, a programming lead, production lead at game studios. And it's going to be very, 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 very few women there. And I think this has a lot of different consequences, because when the people making the hiring decisions and deciding who get promoted tend to be overwhelmingly from one gender, I think you kind of don't value things. And I think one of the consequences of this is really, really straightforward. I think for the consumer, it means you get worse games. I don't know how big a gamer you are, but I feel particularly for this generation, we are really, really, really stuck in a rut of repetitive game design and the same ideas, and we're not innovating the way we used to. I think it's really telling that one of the most innovative pieces of game design to come out in the last few years was Splatoon 2. Which very specifically had a split 50-50 development team. So I think when you have more perspectives there, I think most institutions tend to be better. The what I suspect you and I are going to agree on is how we get there. And I think the feminism of 10 years ago that I really participated in, I think we believed more in checklists. And I'm not really sure that's a good way to go. I think it pits us into this, you know, us versus them mentality. I think rather than like DEI programs, I think we need to be focused on like treating each other with respect and asking ourselves questions like, are different kinds of people being considered for this position? I think that's the way forward.
And that's interesting because it kind of, obviously, right now, we are having this huge national conversation about DEI that kind of was kicked off, especially with the airline industry. But I think it's kind of raised some questions about like, all right, let's say we notice that an industry is disproportionately, perhaps it's disproportionately white, disproportionately male, maybe both white males. Is there a way that we can make sure we're looking at all candidates and judging them fairly and based on merit, and not maybe, you know, perhaps even subconsciously screening people out just because of, you know, X, Y, or Z, while simultaneously recognizing that we should be treating candidates, you know, based on their accomplishments instead of trying to check boxes, like you were saying. Because, you know, as someone who is, I mentioned in conservative media, I have been called a diversity hire before. Oof. And let me tell you, it doesn't feel good. And, you know, right. It doesn't feel good to even have the implication or the suspicion that you're only there, you only have a show, you only have a job, whatever it may be, because of your gender or because of your race. And I think ultimately, like, those types of policies, they're not going to be good for the people they claim to benefit either, because, you know, best case scenario, you're going to have people questioning your qualifications. Worst case scenario, you know, you put someone in a position they're not qualified for. That's not setting them up for success, you know, even potentially having them be in charge of other people's lives, like it is for pilots. So do you see an easy way forward there? Because I think when people look at the gaming industry specifically, I again, not in the video game industry, but I have heard, you know, different devs say online, there are posts about this, that they are maybe a white male, but now they're actually being overlooked despite their qualifications, because now they're the wrong, you know, gender, the wrong race. And I think that's a lot of frustration that we're seeing as a result of these DEI policies.
Right. And, you know, of course, it's going to lead to resentment, right? One of the reasons I stopped saying yes to participating in, you know, speeches at big tech companies, kind of as part of their DEI tracks, is, and this is probably going to get me in some trouble, Lauren, but it's true, is I really started to look into the facts and ask myself a really basic question. Is there science that shows this tact works? Is there, like, any study out there that shows that, you know, bringing in a speaker and having, you know, her lecture everyone there about the evils of white male supremacy, right? Does this lead to better outcomes or better attitudes in the workplace right. for everyone? And I urge my fellow progressives to look at this, because the answer is no. If there are studies that do back this up, they've been conducted in, you know, the last 2 years since I've looked at it, please send them to me. But for me, it's a real crisis of conscience, because, like, I'm looking at the way feminism has been tackling these issues for the last decade. And I'm asking myself a really basic question. We have been involved in a culture war with very, very high stakes for the last decade. Is anyone we are purporting to try to stand for, are they in a better position now than a decade ago, or a worse position? And across the board, women, LGBT people, you know, in many ways, people of color, it is worse by many objective standards. And if you're serious about, like, these objectives, you've got to ask, are our policies working? So, you know, some of the things that do seem to work from the studies I've looked at is, I forget what they call this rule, but, like, basically, if you're going to have a position, it is reasonable to say, if we're hiring for X, Y, or Z, let's make sure that we at least have one woman in the mix or one person of color in the mix, just to make sure we're looking at all the candidates. One of the reasons this works is because without that kind of structure, these organizations tend towards nepotism, where it's who you know, how you know them, who your friends are, and it brings in, like, fresh candidates. So I can support things like that, but if it comes to checklists, I currently have no faith that works anymore.
But I mean, I guess even that, the notion that, oh yeah, we have to have a Black person to help with our hiring, we have to have, you know, let's just say a woman, just to make sure that we're considering those applicants fairly, that still feels a little, I mean, you're checking boxes in a different way. Wouldn't something like perhaps colorblind resumes be a better way forward if we're trying to, because that almost is more leaning into the fact that, yeah, we just can't be expected to treat each other fairly regardless of race or gender. So we have to have someone who can look at their own race fairly. Does that make sense? It feels like almost we're
100%
the fact that we're innately sexist or racist.
100%. I do have to say, it is my experience, and I've hired hundreds of people over my career, that the most important people to look at are the ones with non-traditional backgrounds. Like often the people that take the straight and narrow into a career and have a perfect resume, those tend to be the very, I don't say the worst candidates, but they tend to be the ones that can't think outside the box, or they don't have another life perspective, like our mutual friend, Lauren Southern. Right. You know, she's been through a lot of interesting experiences in the last 10 years, many of them difficult. And I think it leads to a very, very, very interesting perspective that even me as a progressive feminist, I listen to her and I'm like, you know what? This makes a lot of sense to me on a lot of issues. So I worry that with that system, you're kind of going by who looks good on paper and not considering other factors, which I think is important as a hiring manager.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, right now we actually have something like, I mean, you have the CEO of United, I believe, saying we want to have like this quota, you know, for racial, whatever. Are you saying that you would not, you don't support things like that?
I don't have a strong opinion about that. I think they can, I honestly haven't looked into it. What I can say is for me, it's just not the policies I personally focus on. And I don't think it's the way forward. I feel like, you know, like Lauren, you and I have been like conditioned to be part of this culture war. And I just don't think it's getting us anywhere as a country, right? It just seems like more of that in some ways.
No, I think that's definitely fair. You know, I'm someone who's been engaged in the culture war for like 10 years, you know, somewhere between that. It's a bit foggy, but I don't think the country's in a better place since I started doing this. I would say arguably worse. But simultaneously, I see those posts of guys who say, I'm an airline pilot. I can't get a job even though I'm qualified because I'm being looked over for people from a more diverse background. Same thing in Gabe Belt. Like what I'm saying is that it is easy for us to look at the issue of DEI and say that's not really important. It's culture war. And granted, you don't have to focus on any one particular issue as an activist. I very much believe that. But I think it's kind of overlooking the fact that to some people, this is a question of whether they get the job or not.
Yeah.
Because for some people, their industries are being completely run by this mentality. And it's kind of pushing them out of the job market for things they can't control.
I guess I just don't know enough about the airline industry to have really strong feelings there. Do you really think that it's a situation though, where a white guy just can't get hired as a pilot? The little I know about this is that, you know, COVID devastated the airline industry. They laid off a bunch of pilots and then they tried to bring them back. And it's been very difficult staffing it up because of the low pay and the unwillingness to invest in like the training you need to fly these very large commercial jets. That's my understanding of the central problem. Is that correct? Or do you have any knowledge of that?
In my opinion, there are many problems with the airline industry, probably one of my least favorite industries on the planet. let's look at this from a macro perspective. For sure. A long time, pilots were overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. Now, I think it's fair to say that historically, probably there was some discrimination, you know, if we're looking at things in the past, but this was also the case up until fairly recently, up until I would say probably 10 years ago. So then we need to ask ourselves, okay, 10 years ago, was it the case that pilots were disproportionately male and white because of systemic discrimination by all the airlines? Or was it the fact that simply the people who had the most interests and capabilities for being an airline pilot, they happened to be white males? So I think we need to understand what was causing that disparity before we move forward. Because if it is just the case that, I mean, obviously there was sexism, we would want to stop that or racial discrimination, because I'm not for discrimination. However, if it was the case that it's simply the white males who gravitated the most toward this industry and happened to excel in it, then DEI does become a lot more nefarious than the fact that we're trying to, I guess, recruit from applicants outside of that pool means we are like purposefully discarding qualified applicants in favor of people who are less qualified but who check a box. So I can't speak to how many unemployed white male pilots there are right now because of, you know, DEI policies. But I mean, I think the fact that we have to look at other qualities beside just skill at all, I think it does speak to the fact that perhaps there is things aside from merit that are being considered. And I don't want that in my pilots. I would prefer every role just be to the most competent person, but I would say, especially for airline pilots, it's pretty important we get the skills first.
I think that's probably fair. I would, this is again, just me guessing from my little bit of knowledge about this, but as I understand it, one of the biggest reasons for that disparity is because the flight time is so incredibly expensive to procure. And one of the reasons why it's been kind of a little oversaturated in the past is because the biggest school to train people to be pilots has been the military traditionally, right? Which, you know, has its own biases. I'm not like I hate the military liberal. That's not my vibe. But yeah, I think it's factual that there are, you know, have traditionally been more people that look a certain way in that particular role. So maybe, you know, some of these airlines are looking at investing and giving some other people a shot there. Maybe they're not. I would need to look a lot more into it. But I would suspect that the military and kind of their history is one of the larger variables there.
Okay. Well, actually, I mean, speaking of the military, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the Middle East. I think that's going to be interesting. And I feel like people watching this may not expect each of us, if not familiar with us, to have the perspectives that we do. So that's going to be fun. First, though, I do want to say a big thank you to today's sponsor, Beam. If you guys have watched this show before, you'll know how much we love Beam over here. Sleep is so important. And I say that as a mother of a toddler who, you know, sometimes doesn't always get the best sleep. But without proper sleep, your brain's not going to be functioning right. You're probably going to be moody, irritable, and it can even lead to long-term health effects if you don't get at least, I think, 6 to 8 hours, they say, which I don't know about you guys, but oftentimes I certainly don't. So let me introduce you to Beam's Dream Powder. It is a science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep. And what I love about it is that it has a ton of flavors. So chocolate, peanut butter, cinnamon, cocoa, sea salt, caramel, and this actually tastes good. So this is essentially a sleep powder. It has a bunch of ingredients that are backed by science. They're going to help you not only fall asleep, but stay asleep. But it also is like a little snack. So it's just win-win. And today my listeners get a special discount on Beam's Dream Powder. And it is, let's see, 93% of participants have reported that Dream has helped them get a better sleep. So if you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder, get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/Lauren and use the code Lauren at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/Lauren and use the code Lauren for up to 40% off. And my husband, he also uses Beam. I mean, it's great. You basically, just before you go to sleep, mix it in with some hot milk or hot water. And it's like a little treat that also helps you get to sleep and stay asleep. So big fans over here. Big thank you to Beam for sponsoring this video. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on overseas since you mentioned the military. I mean, there's a lot going on. We have war breaking out, it seems like, almost regionally now, not just between Israel and Gaza in the Middle East. We also have Ukraine and Russia. I guess by and large, would you say that you're someone who supports how the administration is currently handling things overseas?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, let's expand upon that a little bit, because under Trump, you know, there are a lot of criticism that could be had about Trump, but we did not see the beginnings of any new conflicts during his time in office, which is something very different than what we see with Biden. Because again, not only do we have Ukraine, Russia, we also have Israel, Gaza, and some people are saying that Taiwan is about to kick off. So I guess maybe a little bit of an explanation about why you think Biden's handling of things has been the way forward.
Well, I'm about to get really geeky from a national security perspective, so I hope that's okay that we could do that. So I think if you look at the highest levels, like what is the organizing principle of like the worldwide economy, right? I think what is happening at the very, very highest levels is we're seeing a tendency for a new axis of power happening across the world. And I think Russia and China are both kind of splintering off into a new axis. And I think at the same time, we have, I think the United States has our new allies, you know, of which would be, you know, obviously everyone over here, but, you know, like the EU, and kind of India's up for grabs as far as being who's going to be, like, are they going to be part of the axis or part of the allies? And even though, you know, Russia and China don't work together explicitly, you know, Japan and Germany did not work together explicitly during the World War. So, you know, I think, or at least they didn't coordinate so much during the World War. So what I think is going on at the very, very highest levels is I think the world is breaking into regions. And I think Russia is kind of on an expansionist bent right now, is trying to take over Ukraine. And I think that they are not going to stop if we don't stop them there. And I think that's going to expand into other territories. I think at the same time, what's happening with Israel, Gaza, this is part of, you know, what Iran calls the axis of resistance, which is Iran working with their terrorist groups like Hezbollah and the Houthis. And basically, they are trying to destabilize the West by any means necessary. So I think that if we don't stand by our allies and stand by democracy, I think we're in some very, very high stakes. Just to give you a really vivid analogy, I want for you to imagine that there's a shield around the United States that's protected both of us for the entire time that we've been alive, and that shield is dissipating, and our enemies are trying to find ways through. I think that if we don't like double down on our commitments to our allies and stop this isolationist bent, I really worry what it's going to mean for the United States economy and the United States workers.
Okay, so a couple of different things there. So, you know, when you talk about a shield protecting the U.S., I feel like my view of U.S. foreign policy is very much affected by the fact that I did not grow up in America. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Hong Kong, also lived in Singapore and the UK. I went to American international schools. About half of the students who would go to these schools were American, and the half were usually like children of expats from other places in the world. What I noticed growing up is that there was a lot of resentment toward Americans from like other countries. And I'm of the belief 100% that the view of foreigners shouldn't necessarily impact how Americans run their own country. Like if other countries don't like the First Amendment, for example, that doesn't mean we should get rid of the First Amendment. But the reason why I think when it comes to foreign policy, maybe we listen to these foreigners a little bit, it's because, you know, Americans tend to look at foreign policy from a very one-sided lens. Like there's this belief that, oh, well, we need to keep ourselves safe. But I don't think there's enough of a lot of the time an acknowledgement that the American government has been a force for destruction for a lot of other countries. And this isn't just historically, but even I would say currently. Yeah. And I think I'm very pro national defense. But if I look at some of these entanglements that the U.S. is getting into, specifically in the Middle East, I have to wonder, how does this make America safer? My background is in Middle East studies and Arabic. That's what I kind of learned in university. And learning about the hostility toward the United States in that region, I was really shocked as a student to learn how much of it really does go back to the U.S. funding of the Israeli regime, which a lot of Arabs feel is, you know, settler colonialist. And even if we're not, you know, big on that progressive lingo, you know, you have to understand this is a government that is, you know, it's bombing other countries. We can go into like whether that's fair or not. But how does the U.S. in backing that and funding that, how does it make Americans safer? The letter Osama bin Laden wrote that kind of went viral not long ago. I don't support Osama bin Laden anyway, let's be clear. But I was kind of surprised how many Americans did not understand the role that blowback had in his motive. So I guess if we could speak to that a little bit.
Well, okay, so let's get through this one at a time. I'm really glad you brought that up, you know, because one of the things that really turned me into a progressive was Mississippi has more people serving per capita than any other state in America. Yep. it's hard for me not to tear up when I think about it, but I had friends die in Iraq because of Bush and his decision to invade there. Again, I want to be respectful to your audience, but you know, I am of the belief that they died for a lie. And I think if you look at the long game of the Middle East is, you know, now Saudi Arabia and Iran are in this Cold War, basically. It was our decision to invade Iraq and basically neutralize this buffer state between Iran and Saudi Arabia that has led to a lot of the skyrocketing tensions. And, you know, it's where the axis of resistance came from, which again is, you know, Iran controlling or basically inflaming and trying to destabilize the entire Middle East by using terrorist groups like Hezbollah and the Houthis. So I'm fully with you on all of that. I think in, you know, I don't want to read too much from your tweets. I'd rather just ask you what your position is. Like, I think you and I would agree that there are many, 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 many examples of the United States entering these conflicts and not, you know, helping it come to a positive, not helping the situation, right? At the same time, I do think that we serve as a form of geostability. And I would, you know, say that what we're doing right now with the Houthis is a really good example of this. You know, we have international shipping. You know, China does almost nothing to participate with keeping our international shipping lanes free of piracy. The United States pays for this for the world. You're welcome. You know, we took care of the Somali pirates, and now we're taking care. You know, we're taking out these terrorists that are basically, you know, they just created this giant oil slick, and they're forcing like worldwide shipping to, you know, take one third longer because it can't use the Suez Canal. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of examples of us constructively engaging the world. And that's why I don't come to this conclusion that we should just like withdraw, American power should withdraw away from all of this and just mind our own business. And just one more thing here, Trump, I think for all the criticism I would have of Trump, he was dead on in like starting to push back against Chinese power in the way that they conduct their trade, which is why Biden hasn't rescinded that. He's actually doubled down on many of Trump's trade policies towards China. So, you know, I think that this is an issue, and I think we can't afford to take a step back.
Well, and so I get called an isolationist a lot, and I find that misleading label because I'm a very big proponent of trade. And I also do believe in diplomacy and, for example, like bilateral decision-making and things like that. I'm not against, especially when it comes to shipping, the U.S. protecting American interests abroad. But I think if we look at the history of the Middle East for the past over 25 years at this point, it's hard for me to view America as a stabilizing force when we look at something like Iraq, right? If we look at that's just a little bit hard. Even if we look at something like Afghanistan, right? I mean, we had how many years of American occupation only for the Taliban to inevitably take it after who knows how many Afghan civilians have been killed and how many American resources and lives were also spent to that cause. And I feel like if we're looking at the history of American involvement, not just in the Middle East, but worldwide, it seems to be that there is a consistent lack of understanding of things like ethnic or like racial or religious tensions in the areas that America tends to get involved in. And I feel like that's not just America, that's the Western world in general. If we look at even kind of the creation of Israel, I think, you know, hindsight being 2020, there's a lot of things that were done by the British mandate that no matter what side of the conflict you're on now, you could say perhaps that could have been done a little bit better if there was more understanding of the region, of the history.
That's such an understatement.
Yeah, right?
I think I would agree with that. Yes.
And so considering that, it's not like the West and America specifically has pivoted somehow in having this greater knowledge or understanding of each of these areas. I just can't see myself advocating for continued U.S. involvement. And that's not even to mention, you know, Dave Smith and I were talking a little bit about it. The libertarian, like, should, like, financially, does it make sense to fund this? If we're just talking about, are we getting results? I mean, what would you say was the last example of successful American intervention abroad?
Oh my God. How about us taking on the Somali pirates, right?
That's fair. I mean, I think that's, but I get, you know, do you draw a difference between something like that versus something like arming Ukraine? Because there's like, I mean, taking on like rebel factions and pirate groups is a little bit of a different flavor than trying to, let's just say, fund a proxy war with Russia, or, you know, fund Israel, perhaps escalating a conflict into a regional, maybe even nuclear war.
Well, I don't see Russia as the dinner. I don't see Ukraine as the dinner for Russia. I think it's an appetizer for a longer expansionist war that would go into, you know, into much of the EU, and I think would, you know, basically force NATO to get involved. And I think it's really, really important to kind of, for your listeners help you understand how it would affect them. Right. This would affect trade for the United States. It would affect, you know, our partnerships around the world. It would leave Americans poorer and with less power throughout the world.
So, are you talking about Russia specifically?
Correct. Russia and their expansionism right there. So I think in this case, it's not just the right thing to do. I think it's cost efficient. And I truly believe that democracy is very much on the line.
Democracy, but I guess democracy for who? Because there have been, you know, do you believe that Ukraine is like a strong democratic nation and we must protect them for that reason? Because there's been, I mean, even before the whole Russia saga, there have been exposés about the amount of corruption in that country, which I don't say to justify what Russia has done, just to be clear. But I see a lot of people try to take up Ukraine is this example of democracy and we must defend it for that. But, you know, seeing that from the outside, I kind of wonder, okay, it seems like there's a little bit of, you know, picking and choosing as to which democracies we defend and when. I mean, Hong Kong arguably is much more of a strong democratic country than Ukraine. When the umbrella protests were happening, you know, there wasn't that same rah, rah, we must arm them, we need to stand for democracy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's not so much them saying Ukraine itself is a bastion of democracy. And by the way, I fully agree with you on Hong Kong. I think that was, I'm not really pleased with the way things turned out there. But I think I would say it's the risk of an expansionist Russia, which would kind of expand this axis of power. You know, I see, I hope this is not too nerdy, but I think we've really struggled for an organizing principle in the United States, like after World War II, right? I think the Green New Deal was one kind of idea that we were going to try kind of to arrange our economy around climate change. I think that obviously is not caught on. I think, you know, Trump tried a new organizing principle with, you know, MAGA, American First, trade wars. I don't think that really caught on. And what I see really happening is I think China, I think it's really not clear right now that if, God forbid, we got in an all-out war with China, we would be able to win. I think that's really, really unclear. And I think China basically treats Russia like a gas station with nukes. So, you know, I think that these two powers, if they were doing their own thing, I think they would manage to take out a very wide chunk of the worldwide economy, which would leave all Western democracies in a much weaker position. So I think it's not just that it's the right thing to do. I think it's about protecting our way of life.
But I suppose, you know, you voiced the fear of an expansionist Russia. And obviously, Vladimir Putin, not just hypothetically, but in practice, we see he has taken Crimea, right? He's attempting to take the ethnically Russian oblast right now. Do you think that there's any credence to the idea that perhaps the same fear was felt on the Russian side regarding NATO expansion?
I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I don't have to think about that. That's just a fact. So,
right. So I guess how do we, each side is distrustful of the other and each side is fearful of the impending expansion of the other. So how do we, I don't want forever wars. You know, Vladimir Putin, he has signaled willingness to come to the table to negotiate. I mean, initially in the 90s, I think Putin even offered to join NATO. I think the way forward would be trying to, I guess, negotiate with Russia and, you know, as much as possible, trying to dispel the idea that the Russian state is inherently an enemy of the West, because otherwise, I mean, it seems like there's no give right now on the American and Western side, and a hard line is being drawn with no care of Russian concerns, which is, I mean, like, obviously no one likes compromise, but this is, you know, this isn't just some little nation you can kick around. The Russian government has shown that they're willing to put lives and money on the lines to defend their own interests.
I hear you on that. And, you know, one of my things is I really believe in the United States State Department. The last time I was on Tim Pool, I spent 90% of the time like defending our State Department. I think Anthony Blinken in particular is my outstanding Secretary of State. You know, diplomacy is always my very first, it's my first preference very strongly. Again, I've had friends die in these forever wars. I feel like their service and their lives were wasted. I don't want to see that. I think I've looked at Russia in the history there and I've come to a different conclusion than you. I don't think you can negotiate with them. I don't think they're interested in stopping. And
we know now that two years ago at the basically start of this war, that there was an opportunity for a peace deal, but that was essentially nuked by the US and the UK.
I don't think I've seen that story. I think I would need to see that. Do you mean like saying the parts that Russia had taken from Ukraine, basically that would be forfeited and Crimea?
There were expected to be, Russia wanted to come to the table and make negotiations. And I'm guessing as part of any cessation of hostilities, there probably would have been some sort of land trade for those oblasts like Donetsk and Luhansk. But it never ended up getting that far because of Western involvement. Do you think that's because there should be no discussion of land swapping or anything like that? Or does that innately make it impossible to make a peace deal with Russia?
I think after the annexation of Crimea in 2010, I think it, you know, again, it's like we tried appeasement there, we tried sanctions, it didn't work, right? And Vladimir Putin came back for more. I do think, unfortunately, you know, the United States is a democracy, and I think the Republicans, their willingness to, you know, support Ukraine, I think there's a timetable on that. And as much as, you know, I can't respect Ukraine's willingness to take back every single centimeter as much as I would be willing to support that indefinitely. I think the other party in our democracy has some different ideas about that. So I don't think that's realistic to keep this war going forever. And I think, unfortunately, yeah, there's going to have to be negotiations at some point. My worry, again, is, you know, that Vladimir Putin's next stop is going to be Poland.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously, I don't want Putin taking Poland, but can you except that there's a little bit of a difference with the situation in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, where we're dealing with ethnically Russian populations who in some cases vote to, you know, have more involvement with Russia. There's discussion as to, you know, Russians actually busing people in to sway the election. So obviously I want to take that into consideration, but that's a little bit of a different scenario than something like Poland. And I don't know if you caught Tucker Carlson's interview with Vladimir Putin, but Ukraine, historically, it seems like that Vladimir Putin has a lot of resentment toward how the fall of the Soviet Union was handled in regard to the breaking up of the Soviet Union. I mean, there's a case to be made, Putin made it, that Ukraine, and specifically the east of the country, it has more Russian influence in history than something like Poland. Like it's a little bit of a different situation. I'm not sure that there's proof right now that we could assume Putin's intent to perhaps go after Poland at some point.
Did you believe his reasons for invading Ukraine in the first place, to stop supposed Nazis in control
I think there is a, you know, if we can say there's a Nazi problem in the US, then I 100% believe we can say that there is a Nazi problem in the UK. But I'm I'm anti-government. I don't believe that Vladimir Putin, acting from the goodness of his heart for love of, like, I don't know, the Jewish people, is invading this country any more than, honestly, I believe that the U.S. government is funding Ukraine out of the goodness of their hearts for the love of Ukrainian people and their democracy.
I think it's a national security issue, you know, and I think a lot of my friends in the Democratic Party don't want to talk about the very risk of democracy even continuing throughout Europe. I think there is I think there are real threats about, I think there's a real consideration of, you know, Islam basically continuing to spread throughout Europe and what that would mean for democracy as, you know, the Middle East continues to destabilize. So, you know, I don't think we're in it for just to be nice people. I think it's our national security interests. And again, this is where I really hope your listeners will pick up from this. This affects you in the sense that if Russia continues expanding and China continues expanding and building up their own trade bloc, this will leave Americans poorer, weaker, with fewer friends and allies around the world. And our Western values, like, they're already becoming out of vogue. I think there's a real question. Do you want to bet on democracy, which is flawed often, or do you want to bet on the authoritarians, which are increasingly on the rise all around the world? I believe in democracy, and I'm willing to defend it at home and around the world.
Oh, right. Well, let's talk about the Islamification of Europe a little bit, because I think, ironically, a big part of that is not just due to, you know, obviously immigration policies, but it is due to Western destabilization of the Middle East. If we look at the Syrian refugee crisis, you can't deny how much of a factor Western influence played in that. Even if we look at, you know, there's perhaps an impending crisis with 2 million Palestinian refugees, I think it's safe to say that, you know, the U.S. funding and Europe supporting Israeli actions in Gaza would also be a big impetus for refugee crises that cause the Islamification of Europe. So it's kind of, you know, I understand the desire to maybe defend democracy, but I just don't know if, again, U.S. actions abroad are defending democracy, especially, like, if we're talking about preventing peace deals from happening, which, yes, might include some land swaps. Is that really defending democracy when now the American people are, I don't even know off the top of my head, how many tens, if not like over $100 billion poorer, and never mind all the Ukrainian casualties that we've seen?
Well, I think I have a different assessment. I think the United States is a variable in those, you know, refugee displacements. I think the major variable is the Cold War between, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia. You know, this is coming back to the Sunnis and Shiites, which is a, you know, conflict which long predates America. And yeah, just for your, so your listeners understand, you know, the Middle East is destabilizing because of this Cold War. Because of these countries. They're all fighting these proxy battles. If you look at what is happening in Yemen, this is very much, you know, Yemen is a war front in this Iran-Saudi Arabia proxy battle, where, you know, the old government, which sucked, is being propped up by Saudi Arabia, and the Houthi rebels, who also suck, are being propped up by Iran, who are providing them weapons. So, you know, I think we certainly have a role to play there. I think it is, I think it's not true to, like, attribute us to be the primary variable for that destabilization.
But, I mean, you mentioned Iran in the 70s, or, you know, but before that, like, Iran had a much less authoritarian, much less extremist government than it currently does. And we have to wonder, well, why exactly, you know, did that government come to be? And I don't think we can ignore the American influence there. The American government, CIA specifically, in the region has a history of, frankly, trying to get rid of these more secular authoritarian governments, you know, because they view them as too strong. I don't think we can ignore the Israeli interest there as well. But inevitably, you know, if not for the authoritarian regime, who is the most organized and the most popular with people? Well, it is the more Islamic extremist faction, and they end up coming into power. I don't think the U.S. can sit back and look, well, oh, I guess we need to meddle more because now that this happened.
I think that's fair. And again, I think a more major variable, a more recent one, was Bush's decision to invade Iraq, which took away a buffer state between them, directly created Al-Qaeda. If you want to look in Yemen at the, you know, U.S., the bombing of the USS Cole, which was a major turning point in our relationships with that country. Yeah, it all comes back to that. I'm fully with you. I think, Lauren, this is where I would respectfully urge you to, I think this is where I really have a difference with you. And this is something as I've really tried to read up and study on this region, that, you know, authoritarianism ultimately doesn't work. It doesn't work when progressives are trying to, you know, basically shame everyone and demonize everyone that disagrees with us. It doesn't work when the fringe right does it. It doesn't work for Vladimir Putin, right? Eventually, these tactics are going to fail. And what I think you see is, as Russia is failing and Iran is failing and a lot of these, you know, smaller proxy countries in the Middle East are failing, there's a real need to blame the failure of the leaders on something. And the most common thing they blame it on is the United States. And like all lies, there is a lot of truth in it, right? But at the end of the day, these are extremely rich countries that could provide for their people. And it's the corruption inherent to authoritarianism that's preventing them to do that. So I agree with you. We are a factor. I agree with you. We need a new strategy in the Middle East, and it's failing, which is why Biden wanted to pivot to Asia. He was very upset that when, like, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, that he could not pivot to Asia, something he's wanted, like we've wanted to do since the Obama era. But at the same time, you know, I don't think the United States is the cause for all the evils in the world. I think we actually do a lot of good.
Well, I definitely wouldn't say it's fair to call the U.S. caught like the great Shaitan, you know?
Right.
I think that would be a huge oversimplification. And, you know, there's plenty of domestic issues that plague Russia, 100% corrupt politics. I mean, the list goes on, ethnic factions within the country, same with Iran and all these Middle Eastern countries. But I guess, you know, when I look at what American influence currently is versus what it could be, you know, the American government could be forging these types of alliances that would be mutually beneficial across the world that wouldn't involve American taxpayers simply sending money overseas to sometimes warlords or corrupt governments where unaccounted millions of, if not billions of dollars would go missing.
Can you get really granular with that? Can you give me an example of what you mean?
Well, yeah, sure. So for example, I mean, when it came to, let's say, I'm trying to think if I should do, when it comes to something like Russia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a way forward. There could be a way forward with greater communication openness between Russia and the U.S., right? Right now, the U.S. is sending billions and billions of dollars to Ukraine for a proxy war. We don't need to be doing that. I think instead of funding coups in Ukraine and essentially trying to, install puppet governments that are friendly to Western sources and simultaneously aggravating someone like Vladimir Putin, I think the U.S. actually could be making great trade inroads with the BRIC countries. And right now, I mean, I don't even know what Biden's position is with Brazil, but, you know, you said India is kind of up for grabs. Russia and the U.S., it's not going well. China and the U.S., at least for the U.S., it's not going well. You voiced concerns about the future of, you know, American trade. The American government is managing to alienate, provoke, and in some ways directly attack basically all of the emerging economies of the world right now, which I don't think. And a lot of the times it's based on Cold War grievances. I mean, what?
Can you give me an example of just one economy you mean by that?
Well, the Russian economy, 100%. So we were told that the international world was taking great sanctions against the Russian economy and that, you know, they would be crippled and they would go down to their knees at the might of these Western sanctions. We see that that is not actually the case, that the international community is not sanctioning Russia. It is the Western world that is sanctioning Russia. But there are plenty of other countries that are still more than happy to trade with Russia. So we have to look at what exactly has the result of these sanctions been. Ultimately, it's been hurting the American consumer. I mean, the fertilizer that we get from Russia, we look at the the European Union, the amount of natural gas that they should have been getting from Russia. Now they've been cold all winter. This is a tangible thing where we didn't need to do these sanctions. We were told that it would cripple Russia. It has not. The only thing it's done is hurt Western consumers.
Don't think I agree with that. I think it is very badly damaged Russia. I think it's very difficult for them to get parts to repair their planes and things like that. Also, I think, you know, it's important but to remember
the sanctions aren't just in regard to, let's just say, like things that could be used for military operations.
Sure, it's banking, foreign investment. Sure. And it's
even things that American consumers specifically might need.
But my larger point here is, you know, it wasn't just the United States carrying out these sanctions. You know, Russia was kicked out of the G8, which is why it's now the G7. Like plenty of our Western, you know.
Right. And my criticism extends to all of them, especially the UK.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
You think the G7, just all of us, are completely wrong on this?
100%. I think when it comes to my criticisms of foreign policy, the EU is largely complicit in everything that I'm talking about, especially if we look at Boris Johnson. Not only did Boris Johnson, like, again, nuke a peace deal, and actually I have an article of it. We can send it, but we don't need to, you know, focus on that one thing because I'm guessing you'd want to read up about it before we could talk about it, which is very, very fair. But his, like, I don't know if you were keeping track of gas prices, energy prices in the UK over these winters, but it's been insane.
Oh, it's been brutal. 100%
have been shut down because of this war that could have been stopped 2 years ago, but that their own leaders decided, no, we're not going to do that. We want this hostility to continue.
So I think that, so let's just walk down your course of logic, because I think we're presenting two different visions to your audiences, right? Like for me, I'm talking the world I see is it's increasingly going to be Russia and China together versus Western democracy. I think the Middle East is going to continue to destabilize. And I think if we care about democracy and prosperity in the West and the standard of living for Western countries, not just America, I think we've got to stick together and defend our values. Which includes like many things like, you know, again, the destabilization of the Middle East that continuing to affect Europe, right? That's my vision, is kind of a unified trade bloc, essentially.
But how is,
hold on just 1 second. And your vision is one where we come to the negotiating table with Russia, who has invaded like Ukraine twice since 2010, and we appease them and also appease China?
I'm not talking about appeasing Russia, but it's ironic to me that we could say, oh, but Russia has invaded Ukraine twice. How many times has the US invaded the Middle East? There's no moral high ground there. So I'm speaking pragmatically. Sure. Pragmatically, I recognize what the Russian interests are with regard to Ukraine. They're afraid of NATO eastward expansion. And considering how afraid some Americans are of Russian westward expansion, that is something that I can understand. I would say, like, I think it was the Minsk Accord, we should have a line in the sand where we say, you know, heck, if we're bringing back the Cold War, let's bring back spheres of influence as well. Let's say we don't go past, you know, whatever line, and we stop trying to fund Western coups, you know, Western, let's say American-friendly politician or movements in other countries. Sure. You know, that to me is very different than saying let's be isolationist, because I want good relations with Russia. I even want good relations with China insofar as they are beneficial to America. And sure. You know, you say that we need to, I guess, stand strong for our values in the face of a Middle Eastern destabilization. Unfortunately, when it comes to the Middle Eastern destabilization, I see the U.S. specifically playing a big role in that. I mean, if we look at, again, the causes of the Syrian refugee crisis, if we look at what's happened in Iraq, there are a lot of problems domestically each of these countries had, absolutely. But when we look at the big conflicts that actually caused people to flee, and I would include Yemen in this, you know, Israel, America, we don't need to be funding these countries and these wars, selling weapons to these types of people. The Western involvement is absolutely, it's a pinnacle here.
Sure. I'm trying to, and I hear you on that. What I'm trying to understand, so your listeners can understand it, help me understand your specific economic vision for what the globe looks like. Like, let's say you're in charge and we stop, basically, let's give a, so for the Middle East, we stop selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They're forced to go to China and Russia. For instance, we stop funding, basically partnering with Israel, and we stop giving, arms to Ukraine. Just to for one example, what is your vision of how that ends up? Like, there's this short term, like, money we're not spending there, but I think the result of that is you're going to have a massive trade block and a large manufacturing
base. I would like to, my goal is I would like to be part of that trade block. That's why I specifically mentioned the BRICS and how the BRIC countries and how the US is antagonizing them. I would like to be part of that trade block.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine with trading with Russia. And actually, as a libertarian, I do believe that, sanctions I'm not a libertarian, but, foreign policy, that's more where I align. I do believe that sanctions in some ways are tantamount to a declaration of war against the country. I would like to be trading with these countries. And I think, simultaneously, if we start trading with these countries, but also open up American energy independence, then we don't simultaneously need to be funding, the Russian state-controlled energy industries or, all of these OPEC countries. The U.S. can stand when it comes to energy on their own, but there are other things that could be cheaper from other countries that aren't necessarily state-run that I don't think it's a bad idea to be trading for.
I guess I think we have I think we would probably both agree, like, China is, I wish I had a less terrible way to say this, but they're not honest in the way they approach many things, including trade, right? Like, there's a lot of shenanigans going on there. I guess.
Well, and China is something that I do support. People have called Trump anti-free trade because of, tough sanction and tariff talk, specifically when it comes to China. I do think that Trump is actually pro free trade, but he is not afraid to use sanctions and tariffs as a negotiating tool. So when it comes to China specifically, we are not currently funding any proxy wars against China. We are not in open, conflict in terms of, weapons or war or anything with China. So my criticisms of how that's being handled are pretty different than what's going on with Russia at the same time, if that makes sense.
I hear you. I think it's worth noting again for all the Democrats that enjoyed critiquing Trump's China trade policy. Biden did not rescind it. He did with our partners. He didn't rescind it with China. He doubled down on it. So, I think there are things like Operation Warp Speed that I would definitely give Trump credit for, and that would be among them. I think all things being equal, I think. I like your vision of the world better. I think the part of it, like communism, that I'm not sold on is human nature, right? And I think human beings have been slaughtering each other for resources since we were going across the plains of Africa. I think that will continue. And I think creating trade blocks with people that share our values, to me, that makes the most sense. And we do still have many types of trade with Russia, like oil and gas being one of them.
Which is ironic, because those are the types of trade where we don't actually need Russia.
That's right.
If we were, properly exploiting, American resources. But Brianna, this has been a lot of fun. I really, really, really appreciate you coming on. I'd be happy to have you on again. For people who want to keep up with what you're doing, where can they do that?
Just follow me on Twitter. If you enjoy seeing me going after the worst of the left, I'm increasingly doing that more and more these days. I'm trying to bring my side back to a little bit of intellectual honesty. And honestly, Lauren, this has been just a fantastic talk. I see, we share a lot of values. And my hope is, no matter who wins this election, if you want to talk about policy that's going to make Americans' lives better in red states and blue states, I very much want that. And I hope we can keep the conversation going.
Absolutely. So again, Brianna, thank you so much for joining. Everyone who's watching right now, please be sure to like, share, subscribe, follow Brianna, and thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.